away from Providence, Rhode Island, welcome to the Potterverse. It's a podcast dedicated to the book and film universe of Harry Potter. So grab your favorite wands and time turners. Let's step into the night and pursue that flighty temptress adventure. And welcome back. My name is Mary Larson.
My name is Blake. And guess what, ladies and gents?
Chickabutt.
Today's my birthday.
Guess what, Chickabutt?
Today is your birthday. Today is my birthday. And there was only a few things that I wanted to do today. I told Mary that I wanted to go see Ant-Man. I told Mary that I wanted to go get a nice steak for dinner. And I wanted a podcast.
We originally were supposed to be in New York.
That's true.
Seeing Phantom of the Opera.
That's true.
But we have not been well, and going to New York and all the traveling and all that kind of stuff probably would have taxed our bodies a little too much.
Yeah.
So we're just going to stay home and use less energy for this birthday weekend. But we are making all of Blake's birthday wishes come true.
That's right. So I can't wait. Haven't got my steak yet, but I seen Ant-Man and I'm about to podcast. Well, I am podcasting, so I am excited about that. By the way, Ant-Man? Pretty good. Quantumania, not bad. I enjoyed it. It was a good film. I know that this is a Harry Potter podcast, but you know what? You're a nerd too. You're at least Ant-Man is nerd adjacent. It's Potter adjacent, if you will.
I wouldn't say Potter adjacent, but I'd say it's nerdy.
Well, it is certainly nerdy.
Yeah.
So I imagine you probably want to go see it too. I would recommend it. Definitely go see it in IMAX if that's the case. But yeah, today is my birthday and I wanted the podcast and we figured we'd podcast about Potter. So that's that. And as a matter of fact, Marvin, you came up with a great idea.
Oh, thank you.
You came up with a fantastic idea, one that I had not yet thought of. And, well, you know what? I'm in on it. And as a matter of fact, if I like it that much, if it turns out to be that good, I might even do this for every last chapter going forward.
Okay.
So, would you care to explain what you'd like to do?
So, we're going to read the last chapter of the book and do commentary as it's read. So it's like you get to hear the last chapter all over again, but with us butting in.
Yes.
Constantly.
Totally ruining your experience. So right. Yes, we're gonna read the chapter. We're gonna comment on it as we read, and that is that. So, Marvin, do you want to tell us what chapter we're reading
today? 37, the beginning.
All right, let's get into it.
I solemnly swear that I'm up to no good.
All right, Marvin, do you want me to start, or do you...
Yeah, you start it up.
Okay, you want me to read? I'll read. All right, chapter 37, the beginning. When he looked back, even a month later, Harry found he had few memories of the following days. It was as though he had been through too much to take in anymore. The recollections he did have were very painful. The worst, perhaps, was the meeting with the Diggerys that took place following morning. They did not blame him for what had happened, on the contrary, but thanked him for returning Cedric's body to them. Mr. Diggory sobbed through most of the interview.
That's my boy! That's my son!
Mrs. Diggory's grief seemed to be beyond tears. He suffered very little then, she said, when Harry had told her how Cedric had died. And after all, Amos, he had died when he'd won the tournament. He must have been happy.
Let's stop for that, okay? What a sin that they cut Mrs. Diggory out of the movie.
Yeah.
Yes, we just got the sobbing Mr. Diggory. But Mrs. Diggory is so sad that she's beyond tears and is able to say, after all, he died just when he'd won. He must have been happy.
Mm.
Oh, Mrs. Diggory. Oh, Mrs. Diggory.
You know what? The funny thing is, Mary, she's concerned about him winning.
No.
No. Hold on.
She's trying to cheer her husband up.
I know. But there's a little bit of... something there.
I don't.
You know
that
what?
Is
he died
the Slytherin
when he won.
Of you. That's
died
the
when
Slytherin
he won.
In you.
Nah, I just.
You know, we would all. Gosh, if you. No, I'm not even going to get into that because it's so sad.
All right. When they had got to their feet, she looked down at Harry and said, "You look after yourself now."
Pause now.
Oh my goodness.
Okay. This is your one kid. I kind of sneakily hoped when I read this book that the Diggorys would almost pseudo, like, take care of Harry.
Yeah.
Check in on him. They lost their son. He's an orphan. His parents were killed by Voldemort. Like, But on the flip side, their trauma is too great. But how wonderfully beautiful would that have been if they occasionally checked in on him, sent him a birthday card?
Yes.
You know, like, we both lost people close to us at the hands of Voldemort.
I don't remember this. I don't remember their involvement at all going forward in the books. So,
and mind you, I don't blame them.
Oh, no, no,
I don't blame
no.
them. They lost their only child in a traumatic way. There's no reason for them to revisit Hogwarts or kids or Harry Potter.
I think that would have been a nice touch if the author had done something like that. Mm. Not necessarily like, oh, we're going to take you in as our pseudo son.
Yeah.
But at least have little things that the Diggories would send Harry every year. Like
next year when there's all that bad stuff happening in the Daily Prophet, if they would send him an owl.
Yeah. Like, just something.
Yes.
And that would
they probably don't even get the Daily Prophet though, because it says Voldemort's not alive.
Yeah. I don't know. I love your take here, Mary. And I'm surprised that the author didn't do something like that at least once.
We'll see. Maybe we forgot.
That's fair. That's fair.
All right.
Harry sees the sack of gold on the bedside table. "You take this," he muttered to her. "It should have been Cedric's. He got there first. You take it." But she backed away from him. "Oh, no, no, no. It's yours, dear. We couldn't. You keep it."
We couldn't? Yours says we couldn't?
Yeah.
Mine says I couldn't.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
Very interesting.
Hmm.
This is hot potato. Harry's like, get rid of this gold that has blood on its hands. Yeah, I couldn't was in the OG text.
Huh, interesting.
Because this is my 2000 book.
Harry returned to Gryffindor Tower the following evening. From what Hermione and Ron told him, Dumbledore had spoken to the school that morning at breakfast. He had merely requested that they leave Harry alone, that nobody ask him questions or badger him to tell the story of what happened in the maze. Most people, he noticed, were skirting him in the corridors, avoiding his eyes. Some whispered behind their hands as he passed. He guessed that many of them had believed that Rita Skeeter's article about how disturbed and possibly dangerous he was. Perhaps they were formulating their own theories about how Cedric had died. He found he didn't care very much. He liked it best when he was with Ron and Hermione, and they were talking about other things, or else letting him sit in silence while they played chess. He felt as though all three of them had reached an understanding they didn't need to put into words, that each was waiting for some sign, some word of what was going on outside of Hogwarts, and that it was useless to speculate about what might be coming until they knew anything for certain. The only time they touched upon the subject was when Ron told Harry about the meeting Mrs. Weasley had had with Dumbledore before going home. "She went to ask him if you could come straight to us this summer," he said, "but he wants to go back to the Dursleys, at least at first." "Why?" said Harry. "She said Dumbledore's got his reasons," said Ron, shaking his head darkly. "I suppose we've got to trust him, haven't we?"
Okay, so why wouldn't Dumbledore just tell Harry there's a spell? Okay, there's a charm that's protected on you when you go to the home of Petunia, who is the blood of your mother, and you need to live there and kind of have it be like your permanent residence. Why wouldn't he just say, "Harry, I know it stinks."
Do we know this in the book? So, like, let's just
we
say...
We as a reader don't know.
Okay, then that's it.
I know.
That's it. That's the reason why. Because there's a mystery involved in all of this.
Yes, but I'm just saying, shame on you, Dumbledore, for keeping this a mystery from Harry.
Yeah, but does the author know that yet, though?
She does right now. She does right now as she's writing this. I think to her it was like, gosh, I'm not going to teach him another charm and go into another level. Let me finish this book up and I'll explain it at some point.
Okay.
But she knows by her saying this, Dumbledore's got his reasons.
Yes.
The author already knew
okay.
the reasons. It's just, I think it's sad that they keep Harry in the dark, especially because it's such a painful thing to go home to the Dursleys where he's bullied.
Mm. Interesting.
Right?
Interesting. All right. The only person apart from Ron and Hermione that Harry felt able to talk to was Hagrid. As there was no longer a Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher, they had those lessons free. They used the one on Thursday afternoon to go down and visit him on his cabin. It was a bright and sunny day. Fang bounded out of the open door as they approached, barking and wagging his tail madly. "Who's that?" called Hagrid, coming to the door. "Harry!" He stood out to meet them, pulled Harry into one-armed hug, ruffled his hair, and said, "Good to see you, mate. Good to see you." They saw two bucket-sized cups and saucers on the wooden table in front of the fireplace when they entered Hagrid's cabin. Been having a couple with Olympi? I don't know. Sure.
In the audiobook, it sounds like he just says imp.
Imp. Okay, sure. Whatevs. Stats for nerds. Hagrid said, she's just left. Who? Said Ron, curiously. Madame Maxime, of course, said Hagrid. You two made it up, have you? Said Ron. Don't know what you're talking about, said Hagrid airily, fetching up more cups from the dresser. When he had made tea and offered round a plate of doughy biscuits, he had leant back in his chair and surveyed Harry closely through his beetle black eyes.
Why does he not say yes? Like, he doesn't have to go into details of their romance and their canoodling, but just...
Hagrid strikes me as the kind of guy that, you know...
Wants to keep his relationship private?
Close to the vest.
Okay.
He wants to keep... never mind.
Okay.
You're all right, he said gruffly. Yeah, said Harry.
Lie.
No, you're not, said Hagrid.
Good.
Of course you're not, but you will be. Harry said nothing. Knew he was going to come back, said Hagrid. And Harry, Ron and Hermione looked up at him, shocked. Knew it for years, Harry. Knew he was out there biding his time. It had to happen.
Codswallop, remember?
Yep, that's true.
Back to Codswallop.
Well, now it has, and we just have to get on with it. We'll fight, maybe to stop him before he gets a good hold. That's Dumbledore's plan anyway. Great man, Dumbledore. As long as we've got him, I'm not too worried. Oh, the foreshadowing.
Oh, but how will this be, Hagrid?
Hagrid raised his bushy eyebrows at the disbelieving expressions on their faces. No good sitting worrying about it, he said. What's coming will come. I always have a wicked hard time reading Hagrid.
As do we all, Blake.
Drives me bananas. What's coming will come, and we'll meet it when it does, Dumbledore told me. Well, you did, Harry. Hagrid's chest swelled as he looked at Harry. You did as much as your father would have done, and I can't give you no higher praise than that. No, his father would have just laid down and died.
I'm upset that he didn't say your parents. I mean, at this point, Harry still holds his dad on such a high pedestal. And
yeah.
Mind you, James Potter is no terrible person. We all have our gray areas, right?
Yes,
and
yes.
And for us to penalize him for what we know that he does in like middle school is rough.
The James Potter stuff is like, he's not a bully, but he's not like a nice
I mean, he's
kid
a bully.
Either. Yeah.
But I'm saying that
it's like Dingleberry
the
stuff.
The memories
like,
that we have of him that we have tarnished our memory of him are from junior high and high school.
Exactly.
And so it's hard to really sit back because we don't flush that out. But right now it's still perfect and Harry.
Although I will say I still hold a wicked hard grudge against all those kids in middle school and high school that made fun of me.
Me too.
Dude, I hate when I go around and like if I'm out in public or whatever, or if somebody messages me on Facebook, oh, hey, Blake.
It's happy good. Birthday.
Happy birthday. Good to see you. Good to talk to you. How you been?
How's
life? I'm just like, if it's a digital
conversation,
I don't even say anything.
Okay.
And then in person, I'm just like, yeah, thanks. And
see,
I walk away.
Is that the Slytherin thing to do, maybe?
I don't know.
Just thanks and go away?
Yeah, I don't know.
What I've done is told them, oh, now you're nice to me? What, Mary? You probably don't remember, but in seventh grade, you made fun of me because I was poor and I had to wear the same blue sweater to church school every week. And you told me I looked like a blue M&M. I don't remember that. Well, you did.
Well, I do.
Yeah. Yep.
Oh, that's right, kids. Hold grudges for the rest of your life.
Then I felt great. I was like, now she knows. Now this 30-year-old woman knows. She scarred me when I was 12. Don't do what I did, friends.
Harry smiled back at him. It was the first time he'd smiled in days. What's Dumbledore asked you to do, Hagrid? He asked. He sent Professor McGonagall to ask you and Madame Maxime to meet him that night. Got a little job for me over the summer, said Hagrid. Secret, though. I'm not supposed to talk about it. Even to you lot, a limp or imp, whatevs, Madame Maxime to you, might be coming with me. I think she will think I got her persuaded. Is it to do with Voldemort? Hagrid flinched at the sound of the name. Might be, he said evasively. Now, who'd like to come in and visit the last Scroot with me? I was joking. Joking!
I love that.
Yeah.
Look at him trying to lighten the mood.
Yeah.
Voldemort just killed a kid. He's back, which obviously Hagrid's known, Codswallop. But he's still able to drop a little humor.
Yeah, just dropping some bombs.
Who wants
here
to come see that Scroot? Just kidding.
Just kidding.
Like, he finally realizes these are terrifying
creatures. And a nice little callback to earlier in the book. All right. It was with a heavy heart that Harry packed up his trunk up in the dormitory on the night before his return to Privet Drive. He was dreading leaving the leaving feast, which was usually a cause for celebration, when the winner of the inter-house championship would be announced. He had avoided being in the Great Hall when it was full ever since he had left the hospital wing, preferring to eat when it was nearly empty, to avoid the stares of his fellow students. When he, Ron, and Hermione entered the hall, they saw at once the usual decorations were missing. The Great Hall was normally decorated with the winning house's colors for the leaving feast. Tonight, however, there were black drapes on the wall behind the teacher's table. Harry knew instantly that they were there as a mark of respect for Cedric. The real Mad-Eye Moody was at the staff table, his wooden leg and his magical eye back in place.
His first meal at the staff table.
He was extremely twitchy, jumping every time someone spoke to him. Harry couldn't blame him. Moody's fear of attack was bound to have been increased by his 10-month imprisonment in his own trunk.
Bless his heart.
Oh, my goodness. Can you imagine how bad that must have smelled? Like, like just sitting in your own
filth. No, they
filth.
Clean it. You know that Bowdy Crouch Jr. was type A, kept things orderly. Oh. I didn't want a stink coming from his room.
Professor Karkaroff's chair was empty. Harry wondered, as he sat down with the other Gryffindors, where Karkaroff was now, whether Voldemort had caught up with him. Madame Maxime was still there. She was sitting next to Hagrid. They were talking quietly together. Further along the table, sitting next to Professor McGonagall, was Snape. His eyes lingered on Harry for a moment as Harry looked at him. His expression was difficult to read. He looked as sour and as unpleasant as ever. Harry continued to watch him long after Snape had looked away.
What do you think Snape was thinking as he's staring at Harry?
Oh, the fact that this... I think he knows there's only one way for all this to end. And his role in it is going to be a big one. Like, as much as he had promised that he'd watch Harry, whatever, like, now there's no turning back. Like, that's what I would think.
I took it as I'm looking at Lily's eyes because the person who murdered Lily is back. And I need to see those eyes to get me revved up to do what I need to
do. Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. It's like to keep you motivated.
Yeah.
To keep you,
I saw like, it as like, I need to look in these eyes.
Yep.
And the sour is that like grief.
Yeah.
But yes, mixed emotions.
Yeah. I think part of that, like I think what I was saying, Mary, I think what you just said is inferred in that.
Yes.
Like the sourness of it all.
I just went to the more romantic angle.
No, you did the right thing. You absolutely did the right thing. What was it that Snape?
But Harry continued to watch Snape. Harry's like, oh, no. I saw your dark mark and I don't know the inner workings. He's probably a little biffed, as we're going to see in the next book.
Sure.
How do I not get told these secret plans? I'm the one that has defeated Voldemort now twice. Okay, continue.
What was it that Snape had done on Dumbledore's orders that night and Voldemort had returned? And why? Why was Dumbledore so convinced that Snape was truly on their side? I love this. Love this. Because we just got confirmation from Dumbledore that all is well, like in terms of Snape, that he trusts Snape, that Snape is doing a thing for Dumbledore. That it's a secret that nobody, like it's so much of a secret that nobody else can know. And Snape knows that what he is doing, at least from his reaction to the thing, is that it's very serious. Like it's, and not Sirius Black, but it's very serious.
We know, Blake.
Yet here is the author through the eyes of Harry still casting doubt on Snape. This is masterful. Absolutely masterful.
He had been
their spy, Dumbledore had said so in the pensive. Snape had turned spy against Voldemort at great personal risk. Was that the job he had taken up again? Had he made contact with the Death Eaters, perhaps? Pretended that he had never really gone over to Dumbledore? That he had been, like Voldemort himself, biding his time? Harry's musings were ended by Professor Dumbledore, who stood up at the staff table. The Great Hall, which in any case was had been less noisy than it usually was at leaving feast, became very quiet. "The end," said Dumbledore, looking around at the mall, "of another year." He paused, and his eyes fell upon the Hufflepuff table. Theirs had been the most subdued table before he had got to his feet, and theirs were still the saddest and palest faces in the hall. "There is much I would like to say to you all tonight," said Dumbledore, "but I must first acknowledge the loss of a very fine person who should be sitting here," he gestured toward the Hufflepuffs, "enjoying our feast with us. I would like you all please to stand and raise your glasses to Cedric Diggory." They did it. All of them.
What do you think's in there? Pumpkin juice?
Pumpkin juice, yeah. Sure. Maybe a little bit of butterbeer to lighten the mood a tad. Yeah, get people a little loose, make some bad decisions.
Yeah.
The benches scraped as everyone in the hall stood and raised their goblets and
make
echoed.
Some bad decisions. We're mourning Cedric.
And one loud, low, rumbling voice, "Cedric Diggory." Harry caught a glimpse of Cho through the crowd. There were tears pouring silently down her face. He looked down at the table as they all sat down again. "Cedric was a person who exemplified many of the qualities which distinguish Hufflepuff House," Dumbledore continued. "He was a good and loyal friend, a hard worker. He valued fair play. His death has affected you all, whether you knew him well or not. I think that you have the right, therefore, to know exactly how it came about." Harry raised his head and stared at Dumbledore. "Cedric Diggory was murdered by Lord Voldemort."
No gray area there.
None. Zero. A panicked whisper swept the great hall. People who were staring at Dumbledore in disbelief, in horror. It looked perfectly calm as he watched them mutter themselves into silence. "The Ministry of Magic," Dumbledore continued, "does not wish me to tell you this. It is possible that some of your parents will be horrified that I have done so, either because they will not believe that Lord Voldemort has returned, or because they think I should not have told you, so young as you are. It is my belief, however, that the truth is generally preferable to lies, and that any attempt to pretend that Cedric died as the result of an accident or some sort of blunder of his own is an insult to his memory." Mm-hmm. Stunned and frightened, every face in the hall was turned towards Dumbledore now, or almost every face. Over at Slytherin table, Harry saw Draco Malfoy muttering something to Crabbe and Goyle. Harry felt a hot, sick swoop of anger in his stomach. He forced himself to look back at Dumbledore. "There is somebody else who must be mentioned in connection with Cedric's death," Dumbledore went on. "I am talking, of course, about Harry Potter." A kind of ripple crossed the great hall as a few heads turned in Harry's direction before flicking back to face Dumbledore. "Harry Potter managed to escape Lord Voldemort," said Dumbledore. "He risked his own life to return Cedric's body to Hogwarts. He showed in every respect the sort of bravery that few wizards have ever shown in facing Lord Voldemort. And for this, I honor him." Dumbledore turned gravely to Harry and raised his goblet once more.
Gravely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like that choice of word.
Yeah. Again, I think it kind of, maybe, well, not maybe, this is certainly colored by what we do know now, but
I mean, the author knew.
The author
with all of this blood stuff, she knows, she may not know every single thing at this point that she's going to be writing in the story, but she knows that Harry Potter is going to have to, in a sense, die.
Yes.
Especially with this blood situation that's gone on.
Yeah.
And,
you know, and typically whenever you have this kind of storytelling, like, you know, the story of like the one, you know, or the one who will bring balance to the Force, or, you know, the one who will make things right. Mm-hmm. It always comes down to the one versus the bad, right? It always comes down to that. So it is within reason that the author knew, okay, this is the story of the one, right? It is going to come down to Harry versus Voldemort. And Harry is going to have to die. But how do I get there, number one? And then two, after he dies, what do I do? So I think it's fair for her to write this through the visage of Dumbledore and say gravely, because she and Dumbledore thereby
don't know.
They know. But
they
don't
know specifics.
But they know that, again, as I alluded to with Snape earlier, there's only one way for this to end.
Correct.
Yeah, I like that. Nearly everyone in the Great Hall had followed suit. They murmured his name as they had murmured Cedric's and drank to him. But through a gap in the standing figures, Harry saw that Malfoy, Crabbe, Goyle, and many of the other Slytherins had remained defiantly in their seats, their goblets untouched. Dumbledore, who, after all, possessed no magical eye, did not see them.
I don't know why the author had that. Is it... To me, that's through Harry's lens. Like, Harry wants them to, wants Dumbledore to notice that they're not picking up their glasses. That Harry's like, look.
Yes.
Look at them.
Yeah. And
they're on Voldemort's side.
Yeah. And it's also, you know, again, knowing where this is going, this is also, I think, a foreshadowing moment, which is pointing to the eventual conflict between Draco and Harry.
Yes.
And what Draco has to do in service of Lord Voldemort.
But to me, what's interesting is I could see these boys and these Slytherins having a problem if Harry came out with all of their names already. Mm-hmm. Malfoy, Crabbe, Goyle, to the press, to whomever, saying, you know, obviously these people's Death Eaters showed up. But he hadn't done that yet. So I just think that it's very interesting that already, maybe these boys were contacted by their parents and they said, whatever you do, stay away from that Potter boy. Mm-hmm. He's bad news. But I just find it quite interesting. But yeah, I love this bit because even though it's not from Harry's perspective, it is.
Yeah.
He wishes Dumbledore could see that they're
absolutely
being not reasonable.
Well, because otherwise, if there wasn't that kind of slant, it wouldn't have been any mention about Dumbledore not having a magical eye. Yeah. When everyone had once again resumed their seats, Dumbledore continued, the Triwizard Tournament's aim was to further and promote magical understanding in the light of what has happened, of Lord Voldemort's return. Such ties are more important than ever before. Dumbledore looked from Madame Maxime and Hagrid to Fleur Delacour and her fellow Beauxbatons students, to Victor Crumb and the Durmstrangs at the Slytherin table. Crumb, Harry saw, looked wary, almost frightened, as though he had expected Dumbledore to say something harsh. Every guest in this hall, said Dumbledore, and his eyes lingered upon the Durmstrang students, will be welcomed back here at any time, should they wish to come. I say to you all once again, in the light of Lord Voldemort's return, we are only as strong as we are united, and as weak as we are divided. Lord Voldemort's gift for spreading discord and enmity is very great. We can fight it only by showing an equally strong bond of friendship and trust. Differences of habit and language are nothing at all if our aims are identical and our hearts are open. It is my belief, and never have I hoped that I am mistaken, that we are all facing dark and difficult times. Some of you in this hall have already suffered directly at the hands of Lord Voldemort. Many of your families have been torn asunder. A week ago, a student was taken from our midst. Remember, Cedric. Remember, if the time should come when you have to make a choice between what is right and what is easy, remember what happened to a boy who was good and kind and brave, because he strayed across the path of Lord Voldemort. Remember, Cedric Diggory.
Okay, so can I stop? So sweet, right? Remember, yeah. Cedric. But I actually don't really get the gist of the rest of what he says here. So when you have to make the choice between what is, where is it? Where's exactly what he says? Remember, if the time should come when you have to make a choice between what is right and what is easy.
Yeah.
Remember what happened to a boy who was good and kind and brave because he strayed across the path. To me, this says, do what's easy, okay? Because he did what was right. And he then strayed across the path of Voldemort. Read it again, because this doesn't make sense.
I hear what you're saying.
Remember, if the time should come when you have to make a choice, okay? So he's telling all the kids,
I think,
do the right thing. Don't just go along with the pack.
Well, I think what he's saying is, it's going to be easy to join Lord Voldemort. But remember what happened to a kid who was good and did the right thing.
Yeah, he died.
But Lord Voldemort, no matter what, is a killer. And even though it might be easy to join him, if you do consider taking the easy route and you do join him, know that he killed.
It needs a little more context
person.
Because the way that it is written,
it is a little confusing.
We all know the gist he's going for.
Yes,
as I assume the students do. But reading this through, when you read the words,
there is room for interpretation.
Yeah.
Yes.
It should have had a little more clarification.
Implicit in the words is that, oh, yes, you're right, Mary. Cedric took the right path.
So and remember.
That got him killed.
He's straight across the path of Voldemort for being
so
good.
So do the right thing.
And kind and brave.
You'll die.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah, that's what it sounds like.
Which, I mean, exactly what happens to Harry Potter. So. Yes. Truth teller, Dumbledore, not as uplifting. I would have heard this speech and been sitting there scratching my head going,
be like, yeah.
So is he telling us to take the easy route to not die?
Is this like a path of least resistance thing?
Can I go be a muggle?
Should I be taking manifestation courses right
maybe
now?
Maybe I could pretend I'm a squib.
The law of least action, maybe? I don't know.
Maybe I'll just transfer to Bobaton because they don't get involved in the Battle of Hogwarts.
Does Eton still have openings? Harry's trunk was packed. Hedwig was back in her cage on top of it. Ron and Hermione are waiting in the crowded entrance hall with the rest of the fourth years for the carriages that would take them back to the Hogsmeade station.
The carriages. Pulled, of course.
By... what the hell are they called?
I'm having a brain fart, which I'm super embarrassed with. Thestrals.
Thestrals. There you go. Thank you so much. It was another beautiful summer's day. He supposed that Privet Drive would be hot and leafy. Its flower beds. Its flower beds are riots of color when he arrived there that evening. The thought gave him no pleasure at all.
Harry! He obviously does not go to the gardening shops.
Yeah, nobody cares about flowers when somebody's croaked. Like that.
No. It's probably just reminding
him. Hey, why
of
didn't
death.
Harry see the Thestrals right now?
That's a great question.
Like, but I get why he sees them in the fifth year, but why doesn't he see them now?
Well, he's waiting with the rest of the fourth year, so they haven't pulled up yet.
True.
But yet, you're right. Yeah.
He looked around. Flora Delacour was hurrying up the stone steps into the castle. Beyond her, far across the grounds, Harry could see Hagrid helping Madame Maxime to back two of the giant horses into their harness. The Beauxbatons carriage was about to take off. "We will see each other again, I hope," said Flora as she reached him, holding out her hand. "I am hoping to get a job here."
I'm believing it's because he's still in shock and he hasn't digested it yet.
"To improve my English." I should improve my English too, Flora. Sorry. "It's very good already," said Ron in a strangled sort of voice. Flora smiled at him. Hermione scowled. "Goodbye, Harry," said Flora, turning to go.
"Goodbye, Harry.
Goodbye, Harry. It has been a pleasure meeting you." Harry's spirits couldn't help but lift slightly as he watched Flora hurry back across the lawns to Madame
Maxime.
It's
like they float.
Her silvery hair rippling in the sunlight. "Wondering how the Durmstrang students are getting back," said Ron. "Do you reckon they can steer that ship around without Karkaroff?" "Karkaroff did not steer," said a gruff voice. "He stayed in his cabin. Let us do the work."
Oh, what a jerk Karkaroff was.
Crumb had come to say goodbye to Hermione. "Could I have a word?" He asked all these. Why did I choose to read this chapter?
I'm so glad I suggested this.
Oh, man.
Oh, yes. All right.
Oh, yes. All right, said Hermione, looking slightly flustered and following Crumb through the crowd and out of sight. "You'd better hurry up," Ron called loudly after her. "The carriages will be here in a minute." He let Harry keep a watch for the carriages, however, and spent the next few minutes craning his neck over a crowd to try and see what Crumb and Hermione might be up to. Oh,
you know what I was thinking about?
What?
I wonder if when Ron leaves Harry and Hermione in the tent...
Mm-hmm.
You know, when they're on this quest of trying to figure out how to break the Horcrux where the rest are. I wonder if Hermione ever sits there and says, "I wonder if Crumb would have left me."
Oh, I like that. No chance Crumb would have left her.
No chance.
0.0 chance.
No chance.
Even with the Horcrux and everything. Like if that Horcrux, even if it was being around him, forget about it.
I don't think Crumb would have left.
No way.
And does Hermione ever daydream? What if I had stuck with him?
the amount of galleons she would have right now.
She wouldn't care about the money. She wouldn't care about the money. She's Minister of Magic. Could that power couple?
Oh
my gosh! Because he went early into retirement.
Yeah.
So he'd be, you know, helping out with the kiddos. She'd be rocking her career since he had his turn.
It'd be like Tom Brady and Giselle. Oh. Oops.
Not at all like them.
No.
But I do. I wonder if she'd ever sit there and say, he wouldn't have left me. Because she would have just seen him at the wedding. He's at Fleur and Bill's wedding.
Yep. Absolutely.
And when Ron leaves.
No chance he would have left her.
Crumb wouldn't have left me.
Ron stared at Hermione, but her face was impassive. I liked Diggory, said Crumb abruptly to Harry. He was always polite to me. Always. Even though I was from Darmstrang with Kakarov, he added, scowling.
I read that as, have you found a new hairdresser yet? Have you got a new hairdresser yet?
You got a new hairdresser yet? Red hair.
Hand me down clothes.
Must be a Weasley.
Okay, I'm having major deja vu.
Have you got a new headmaster yet, said Harry. Crumb shrugged. He held out his hand as Fleur had done, shook Harry's hand, and then Ron's.
Now, what I love about this is Fleur stuck out her hand for Harry.
Yeah.
But it didn't say that for them to shake it. This is when you realize, oh, they were shaking it. I thought Fleur was being Fleur, sticking out her hand for Harry to kiss it.
Yeah, right.
Because it didn't say she stuck out her hand. Yeah. And then they shook it. It just said she stuck out her hand.
Hmm. Ron looked as though he was suffering.
Yeah, it said, as Fleur, we will catch each other again, I hope, said Fleur. She reached him, holding out her hand. I was hoping to get a job here to improve my English. So I'm just picturing her standing there
the whole time
with her hand out, ready for him to kiss it. And then it's not until we get the acknowledgement that he shakes their hands.
Oh, man. Ron looked as though he was suffering some sort of painful internal struggle. Crumb had already started walking away when Ron burst out, can I have your autograph?
See? I'm Ron.
Totally, I'm Ron.
I know.
You are so book Ron. Oh, my God. Can I have your autograph? I can totally see.
I love what you do. I'm totally Ron. Book Ron. There is a big distinction.
I love what you do. Oh, my God. Hermione turned away, smiling at the horseless carriages, which were now trundling towards them up the drive, as Crumb, looking surprised but gratified, signed a fragment of parchment for Ron. The weather could not have been more different on the journey back to King's Cross than it had been on their way to the Hogwarts the previous September. There wasn't a single cloud in the sky. Harry, Ron, and Hermione had managed to get a compartment to themselves. Pigwidgeon was once again hidden under Ron's dress robes to stop him hooting continually. Hedwig was dozing, her head under her wing. And Crookshanks was curled up in a spare seat like a large, furry ginger cushion. Harry, Ron, and Hermione talked more fully and freely than they had done all week as the train had sped them southwards. Harry felt as though Dumbledore's speech was at the leaving feast had unblocked him somehow. It was less painful to discuss what had happened now. They broke off their conversation about what action Dumbledore might be taking even now to stop Voldemort, only when the lunch trolley arrived.
Oh, by the way. You were talking about Thestrals. Neville can see Seth Thestrals.
Oh, yeah.
Because he saw his grandfather die. But it's different in the movies.
Yes.
So it's an interesting thing.
Interesting.
Sorry.
When Hermione returned from the trolley and put her money back in the school bag, she dislodged a copy of the Daily Prophet, which she had been carrying in there. Harry looked at it, unsure whether he really wanted to know what it might say. But Hermione, seeing him looking at it, said calmly, there's nothing in there. You can look for yourself, but there's nothing at all. I've been checking every single day, just a small piece the day after the third task, saying that you won the tournament. They didn't even mention Cedric. Nothing about any of it. If you ask me, Fudge is forcing them to keep quiet. He'll never keep Rita quiet, said Harry. Not on a story like this. Oh, Rita hasn't written anything at all since the third task, said Hermione, in an oddly constrained voice. As a matter of fact, she added, her voice now trembling slightly, Rita Skeeter isn't going to be writing anything at all for a while. Not unless she wants me to spill the beans on her. What are you talking about? Said Ron. I found out how she was listening in on private conversations when she wasn't supposed to be coming into the grounds, said Hermione in a rush. Harry had the impression that Hermione had been dying to tell them this for days, but she had restrained herself in light of everything that else that had happened. "How was she doing it?" said Harry at once. "How did you find out?" said Ron, staring at her. "Well, it was you, really, who gave me the idea, Harry," she said. "Did I?" said Harry, perplexed. "How?" "Bugging," said Hermione happily. "But you said they didn't work." "Oh, not electronic bugs," said Hermione. No, you see, Rita Skeeter," Hermione's voice trembled with quiet triumph, "is an unregistered animagus. She can turn," Hermione pulled a small sealed glass jar out of her bag, "into a beetle."
"You're kidding," said Ron. "You haven't. She's not."
"Oh, yes, she is," said Hermione happily, brandishing the jar at them. Inside were a few twigs and leaves and one large, fat beetle.
"That's never. You're kidding,"
Ron whispered, lifting the jar to his eyes.
"You know he is pumped."
"No, I'm not," said Hermione, beaming. "I caught her on the windowsill in the hospital wing. Look very closely, and you'll see. And you'll notice."
I am shocked that none of this trio decides to become an unregistered animagus themselves. After all of the research that they do,
yeah,
and the amount of people that they know, I'm just shocked. I feel like one of them would have done it. Would have also probably become very useful. Hermione obviously would have had the determination to do it. I feel like Ron would have just thought, screw it, I'm not wicked smart and I'm not Harry Potter. I need to have some really cool skill. Yes. I'll take one for the team. I feel like Ron would have been a really great animagus.
No, I don't. I feel like Hermione would have been a good animagus.
Why wouldn't Ron?
I don't know why.
He would. Just like with that whole 30 diet, I don't think Ron could keep a leaf under his mouth
the whole 30.
For 30 days. Isn't that what they had to do? They have to keep a leaf under their tongue?
Yeah, for 30 days. Mm. Apparently, didn't they say like tastes awful or something? Yeah. I can't remember what it was.
I don't know if Ron would have liked that.
"No, I'm not," said Hermione, beaming. "I caught her on the windowsill in the hospital wing."
Fred and George would have done it.
"Look very closely, and you'll notice the markings around her antennae are exactly like those foul glasses that she wears." Harry looked and saw that she was quite right. He also remembered something. There was a beetle on the statue the night we had heard Hagrid telling Madame Maxime about his mum. "Exactly," said Hermione. "And Victor pulled the beetle out of my hair after we'd had our conversation by the lake. And unless I'm very much mistaken, Rita was perched on the windowsill of the divination class the day your scar hurt. She's been buzzing around for stories all year." "When we saw Malfoy under the tree," said Ron slowly, "he was talking to her in his hand," said Hermione. "He knew, of course. That's how she's been getting all those nice little interviews with the Slytherins. They wouldn't care that she was doing something illegal as long as they were giving her horrible stuff about us and Hagrid." Hermione took the glass jar back from Ron and smiled at the beetle, which was buzzed angrily against the glass. "I've told her. I'll let her out when we get back to London," said Hermione. "I've put an unbreakable charm on the jar, you see, so she can't transform. And I've told her that she is to keep her quill to herself for a whole year. See if she can't break the habit of writing horrible lies about people." The door of the compartment slid open. "Very clever, Granger," said Draco Malfoy. Crabbe and Goyle were standing behind him. All three of them looked more pleased with themselves, more arrogant and more menacing than Harry had ever seen them. "So," said Malfoy slowly, advancing slightly into the compartment and looking around at them, a smirk quivering on his lips, "you caught some pathetic reporter and Potter's Dumbledore's favorite boy again. Big deal." His smirk widened. Crabbe and Goyle leered. "Trying not to think about it, are we?" said Malfoy softly, looking around at all three of them. "Trying to pretend it hasn't happened?" "Get out," said Harry. He had not been near Malfoy since he watched him muttering to Crabbe and Goyle during Dumbledore's speech about Cedric. He could feel a kind of ringing in his ears. His hand gripped his wand under his robes. "You've picked the losing side, Potter. I warned you. I told you you ought to choose your company more carefully, remember? When we met on the train, first day at Hogwarts, I told you not to hang around with riffraff like this." He jerked his head at Ron and Hermione. "Too late now, Potter. They'll be the first to go, now that the Dark Lord's back. Mudbloods and muggle lovers first. Well, second. Diggory was the and it was as though somebody exploded a box of fireworks within the compartment, blinded by the blaze of spells that had blasted from every direction, deafened by a series of bangs. Harry blinked and looked down at the floor. Malfoy, Crabbe, and Goyle were all lying unconscious in the doorway. He, Ron, and Hermione were on their feet, all three of them having used a different hex. Nor were they the only ones to have done so. "Thought we'd see what those three were up to," said Fred matter-of-factly, stepping on to Goyle and into the compartment. He had his wand out, and so did George, and was careful to tread on Malfoy as he followed Fred inside. "Interesting effect," said George, looking down at Crabbe. "Who used the furunculus curse?" "Me," said Harry. "Odd," said George lightly. "I used jelly legs."
I love this. I love this part so much.
Because this is totally what Mary would do.
What would I do?
The whole thing. Just like not listening to Crabbe and Goyle and Malfoy.
Just
and
goodbye. Just furunculus.
Yeah, like just dropping
jelly legs.
Hexes and jelly legs. And
that's how we roll as Dumbledore's man.
That is a Garen fracking
team. We're not here to talk things out. You're being mean.
"Odd," said George lightly. "I use jelly legs. Looks as though those two shouldn't be mixed." He seems to have sprouted little tentacles all over his face. "Well, let's not leave them there, shall we? They don't add much to the decor." Ron, Harry, and George kicked, rolled, and pushed the unconscious Malfoy, Crabbe, and Goyle, each of whom looked distinctly the worse for the jumble of jinxes with which they had been hit, out of the corridor, then came back into the compartment and rolled the door shut. "Exploding snap, anyone?" said Fred, pulling out a pack of cards. They were halfway through their fifth game when Harry decided to ask them. "You're going to tell us, then," he said to George, "who you were blackmailing." "Oh," said George darkly, "that." "It doesn't matter," said Fred, shaking his head impatiently. "It wasn't anything important. Not now, anyway." "We've given up," said George, shrugging. But Harry, Ron, and Hermione all kept asking. And finally, Fred said, all right, if you really want to know, it was Ludo Bagman." "Bagman?" said Harry sharply. "Are you saying he was involved in—" "Nah," said George gloomily. "Nothing like that. Stupid git. He wouldn't have had the brains." "Well, what then?" said Ron. Fred hesitated and then said, "You remember that bet we had with him at the Quidditch World Cup and about how Ireland would win but Crumb would get the snitch?" "Yeah," said Harry and Ron slowly. "Well, the git paid us in leprechaun gold he'd caught from the Irish mascots."
So,
said Fred impatiently, "it vanished, didn't it, by the next morning? It had gone. But it must have been an accident, mustn't it?" said Hermione. George laughed very bitterly. "Yeah, that's what we thought at first. We thought if we just wrote to him and told him he made a mistake, he'd cough up. But nothing doing. Ignored our letter. We kept trying to talk to him about it at Hogwarts, but he was always just making some excuse to get away from us. In the end, he turned pretty nasty," said Fred. "Told us we were too young to gamble, and he wasn't going to give us anything." "So we asked for our money back," said George, glowering. "He didn't refuse," gasped Hermione. "Right in one," said Fred. "But that was all of your savings," said Ron. "Tell me about it," said George. "Of course, we found out what was going on in the end. Lee Jordan's dad had a bit of trouble getting money off of Bagman as well. Turns out he's in big trouble with the goblins. Borrowed loads of gold off of them, and a gang of them cornered him in the woods after the World Cup and took all the gold he had, and it still wasn't enough to cover all the debts. They followed him all the way to Hogwarts to keep an eye on him. He's lost everything gambling, hasn't got two galleons to rub together. And you know how the idiot tried to pay the goblins back?" "How?" said Harry. "He put a bet on you, mate," said Fred. "Put a big bet on you to win the tournament. Bet against the goblins." "So that's why he kept trying to help me win," said Harry. "Well, I did win, didn't I? So he could pay your gold." "Nope," said George, shaking his head. "The goblins play as dirty as him. They say you drew with Diggory, and Bagman wasn't betting you'd win outright. So Bagman had to run for it."
Shady, shady.
"He made a run for it right after the third task." George sighed deeply and started dealing out the cards again. The rest of the journey passed pleasantly enough. Harry wished it could have gone all summer. In fact, and that he would never arrive at King's Cross. But as he had learnt the hard way that year, time will not slow down when something unpleasant lies ahead. And all too soon, the Hogwarts Express was slowing down at the platform 9 3/4. The usual confusion and noise filled the corridors as students began to disembark. Ron and Hermione struggled out past Malfoy.
Can I just say, I am shocked that like half the student body didn't immediately go home after this tragedy.
Yeah. You would think that that would be the end.
I mean, probably there were loads of parents there anyway,
yep,
watching the Triwizard Tournament. Mm-hmm. This is such a rare thing. If that were me,
I'd take my kid right home. See you later.
All right. Cedric Diggory died.
Yep. We're going to let this all blow over.
All set. My kid doesn't need this trauma. He's 11.
Yep.
Right?
I'm only in the third grade.
Get those owls from what's his name? The little kid with the camera.
We love Colin. So dearly.
Yeah, little Colin.
Yeah, little Colin McCreevy.
Hey, Mom.
There. Hey, guess who died?
This kid who was really nice to me died. And then Dumbledore said that Voldemort's back. It's kind of scary here.
And then he was trying to tell us to take the easy route, but maybe not.
But that means you're dead? Remember, or don't die? I don't know, Mom.
I was kind of confused.
But it's great, because now I don't have Defense Against the Dark Arts classes.
It's just a free period now. I can do whatever I want.
I just color or write in my journal. Come get me. I'm scared.
Oh, man. Ron, Hermione struggled out past.
Like, no letter went home?
I feel like
do the Dursleys not get a letter as the guardians of Harry Potter?
You would think that they would get a letter, but there's no chance they opened it.
Oh, because it came from owls.
Yeah, so that'd be it. They'd be like, yeah, okay.
Owls!
Cool. Right. No posts on Sundays. Ron and Hermione struggled out past Malfoy, Crabbe, and Goyle carrying their trunks. Harry, however, stayed put. Fred, George, wait a moment. The twins turned. Harry pulled open his trunk and drew out his Triwizard winnings. Take it, he said, and he thrust the sack into George's hand. What? Said Fred, looking flabbergasted. Take it, Harry repeated firmly. I don't want it. You're mental, said George, trying to push it back at Harry. No, I'm not, said Harry. You take it and get inventing. It's for the joke shop. He is mental, Fred said in an almost awed voice. Listen, said Harry firmly. If you don't take it, I'm throwing it down the drain.
Harry has tried to get this money away from him.
Oh, I know. So
many
much.
Times. It's blood money to him. He is just all set. And he doesn't need it.
Yeah, right.
And I love what he does here.
I don't want it and I don't need it. But I could do with a few laughs. We could all do with a few laughs. I've got a feeling we're going to need them more than usual before long. Mm-hmm. Harry, said George weakly, weighing the money bag in his hands. There's got to be 1,000 galleons here. Yeah, said Harry, grinning. Think how many canary creams that is. The twins just stared at him. Just don't tell your mom where you got it, although she might not be so keen for you to join the ministry anymore, come to think of it. Harry, Fred began, but Harry pulled out his wand. Look, he said flatly, take it or I'll hex you. I know some good ones now. Just do me one favor, okay? Buy Ron some different dress robes and say they're from you. He left the compartment before they could say another word, stepping over Malfoy, Crabbe, and Goyle, who were still lying on the floor covered in hex marks. Uncle Vernon was waiting beyond the barrier. Mrs. Weasley was close by him. She hugged Harry very tightly when she saw him and whispered in his ear, I think Dumbledore will let you come to us later in the summer. Keep in touch, Harry. See you, Harry.
Keep in touch, please.
Oh, and then knowing what happens mm-hmm. this summer, how they yep. just completely... Like, they send him stuff, right? No, they...
No, because the Dumbledore tells them
yeah, not to
don't
go.
Tell
yeah.
him stuff yeah. about the Order of the Phoenix.
Yes.
So it's not like Dobby's holding his post like he did
right.
years before.
Right.
Harry is now going to go through significant mourning.
Yeah.
And not hear from his friends at the same
yeah.
time.
And then we get the best Harry, which is emo Harry.
Blake's favorite.
See ya, Harry, said Ron, clapping him on the back. Bye, Harry, said Hermione. And she did something she had never done before and kissed him on the cheek. Harry, thanks, George muttered, and Fred nodded fervently at his side. Harry winked at them, turned to Uncle Vernon, and followed him silently from the station. There was no point worrying yet, he told himself, as he got into the back of the Dursleys' car. As Hagrid had said, what would come, and he would have to meet it when it did. The end. So the first thing that pops in my brain after mm-hmm. reading that is how many Hermione and Harry shippers were freaking out when Hermione gives Harry a kiss on the cheek.
Oh, everybody. But mind you, we've also now gone through this story where we're seeing the Ron Hermione romance blossom.
Yes.
So you've gone this whole entire time being told Ron's hankering for a hunk of Hermione.
Yes.
So I can definitely see why people get confused.
Sure.
But to be honest, as a girl who was once 14, 15, I was more friendly with people who I didn't have crushes on. And I would be more forward with hugging, or if I did kiss on the cheek, which I don't. But if I were to do that, it would be with a friend.
I'm not a big kiss on the cheeker person either.
Oh, I am now.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm not. Like, I'll give you a hug. We'll do the hug thing. But the kiss on the cheek thing? If I see my family, like, that's one thing. But, like, other people, like, I don't know, that's a space that's reserved for my wife.
I appreciate that. We're also like tough New England Americans.
Yeah, that's true. Good point.
Don't touch me.
Don't touch me. I don't need to be touched. Hey, wait, you got any Sammies in the fridge?
You can kiss my hand like I believed Fleur Delacour did.
Was just sitting there waiting. Hand out.
Yes.
All right, Marvin. You got anything else that you would like to say about this chapter, about this book?
This book is just lovely. And this, of course, I should be asking that of you, Blake, because this was your first time ever reading The Goblet of Fire, and now you've finished it. So what are your thoughts? Inquiring minds want to know.
So ultimately, I think after reading the book, I think they did the book justice in its adaptation for the film.
Okay, I'm just saying, talk to us book alone.
Right.
Because you're saying the only premise that you had to go on was the film for Goblet of Fire.
Having said that, I enjoyed the book. I enjoyed the book more than I thought I would. There is a lot more
magic
there. To me, this feels like two different books.
Okay.
It feels like Wee Hogwarts, and then it feels like, okay, now we're getting to the thing.
Yes.
And the Wee Hogwarts thing, like, is okay. Like, we just watched Ant-Man, as we had mentioned earlier, right? And all the stuff with Ant-Man, the Quantumania, it was good. But I feel like it was two different movies.
Agreed.
It was the wee Quantum World stuff.
Which reminds me a lot of Naboo.
Yes, very. It's very Naboo. Which was great.
Lisa.
I loved when you made that comment after the I asked Mary, hey, did you like the film? She goes, yeah, I did. But it was a little too much Naboo for me. But then the second part of the film was, you know, and this isn't a spoiler, but it was like Kang and what's coming. And it felt like there were two different movies. And this is very much the same for me. I would actually say that Quantumania and Goblet of Fire are very similar. In terms of structure and in terms of presentation and the point of the films.
Interesting.
Right? There's a lot of mythology that's involved in both in terms of the backstory and how people got there, what happened, where the protagonists are in their life. Mm-hmm. In particular, Harry has already gone through the third book. He's pretty confident in his abilities. He just wanted a normal life. The same thing can be said of Ant-Man, right? He's gone through all the stuff. He helped save the world. He helped do the whole thing, and he wants a normal life now. He just wants to be a dad. And he has his book, and he's moving on with life. And then there are things that are happening that are larger than him that he's now a part of, and he can't escape it. And the same thing happens in this book. And as Quantumania sets the MCU up to go forward, Goblet of Fire does that for Harry Potter.
Okay.
Yes. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So it's kind of apropos that we saw that film at the same time that we're ending this book, because they're both long. They're both
intense world building.
Intense world. Yeah, absolutely. And I would say that a good quarter of it could probably be edited out, and you'd still get
Which is what we get in the movie version.
Yeah.
And I mean, even, we lose Ludo Bagman entirely. Yeah. Doesn't exist.
You lost Cedric's mom.
Bless her. So upset she can't even cry.
Yeah. You lose Ludo Bagman. You lose the whole betting thing. You lose all of Spew. And that's why I say I think the film did the book justice in terms of its...
what they could accomplish in a film.
Okay. And focusing specifically mm-hmm. on Harry. Right. I think that there's some emotional stuff, especially as it relates to the relationship shared between Harry and
Moody?
Cedric.
Oh, yes. Yes. Oh, you mean things that we miss out on. So this is more just you speaking about things that were fleshed out for you a bit more by reading the book for the first time.
Yeah. I got a greater appreciation for Cedric in the book than I did in the film.
Agreed.
And the film,
he's dreamy in the film.
He's dreamy, and like I don't know, I don't get the sense of how good of a person he was, mm-hmm. the way that I do in the book.
Yes,
you know what I mean. And that to me, I think, is a problem because the book does a great job establishing that yes, these two students were, you know, they were cordial and they were. Friendly, but not friends. And yes. But by the end of the book, they had come to an understanding and an appreciation of each other where they could both say, like, let's do this
let's
together.
Both win. Mm-hmm.
And like they do it in the film, but it just hits differently in the book.
Agreed.
But I would say that the film does a better job with the tasks than the book does.
They did a fantastic job bringing the tasks to the screen. I agree. Yeah. They came in and they said, let's make these dragons a big deal. Mm-hmm. Let's spend some awesome money underwater.
Yep.
And let's make this labyrinth look really scary.
Yeah. And the labyrinth was scary. There is, I think, a little, again, as we had mentioned with the relationship between Cedric and Harry, there is some stuff missing out of the labyrinth that should have been in it at the end of the film to make that punch harder. Mm-hmm. But I think it gets across, but you don't feel it the way that you should feel it. So yeah, when I say that this book gives me a greater appreciation of the story, I would say yes for the most part. But not like, you know, it also kind of reminds me of Voyager, like, you know, for you Outlander fans, right? Voyager, there was like a lot of stuff that happened.
Yes.
Just stuff.
I mean, hello, look at the name of the title.
I know. But there were some cool things in Voyager, but it was stuff. And I feel like a lot of it could have been cut out to make a more streamlined story. The same thing with Goblet of Fire. So, I enjoyed it. I'll say that. So... I've been doing a lot of talking in this episode.
No, it's honestly, like, you're the one that got to see this book through fresh eyes. And I think that that's what's so exciting for me is to have you talk about it. Mm-hmm. Like, I can't rewind to 2000 with little 18-year-old Mary mm-hmm. sitting at the water park that I worked at, telling kids when they can go down a water slide, being ever so grateful for rainy days. Mm-hmm. When I could continue to read Goblet of Fire and kids didn't show up to go on a water slide.
Yep.
That was 23 years ago when I saw this book with fresh eyes. So to be able to hear your perspective on it, granted you knew the plot line because of the movies sure. and then the future books that you've read, but I love that.
Yeah.
And now you see why for many people this is their favorite book.
Yeah, I get it. Because there's a lot of whimsy in it. Mm-hmm. Probably not as much as, you know, the first book.
But we flesh out the characters. I mean, even what we get between Fred and George and Harry saying, make sure you buy Ron a new robe. Like, I just feel like because this book was substantially bigger, mm-hmm. we were able to develop our characters.
Yeah, and we're able to give Harry something more than just, I'm the one. I'm the mm-hmm. chosen one, right? We're even alluding to Cho here and what's what's going to happen with her, mm-hmm. right? And Harry dealing with those feelings, especially as you know, one go ball with me, you know. We're starting to move into that territory, mm-hmm. which is more than just okay, good versus evil.
Yes.
It's okay. We also have a kid here who is developing his own sense of self, mm-hmm. and then at the same time also having to deal with the fact that he is Harry freaking Potter and maneuver through a perfect example of Harry freaking Potter is the fact that somebody came up with enough of a plan to put his name into the Goblet of Fire because he's Harry freaking Potter.
Yeah.
Right? And we all know why, obviously, since we've read the book now and whatever. But like, there are things that are happening around Harry that Harry has absolutely no control over, but still guide his life.
Mm-hmm.
That still push him in directions that he, as he said, trouble kind of finds him. And he's right. Trouble does kind of find him. He has no intention of doing anything. He even says that at the beginning of this book. I just want to be, I don't want to do anything. Mm-hmm. I just want to be a normal kid. I don't want to stand out. Yeah.
You know, we've talked about it before. When you watch the movies, they were very careful about the colors in which they dressed Harry.
Sure.
They always dressed him in muted grays and blues, knowing that he, as a person, would want to just blend in mm-hmm. and not stand out. And it's just interesting, you know, to think of those layers of this child.
Yeah, and it's I think the story works so well because we do have this child who wants nothing more than to just be a normal kid. And there are two things that are pushing him in the opposite direction that are completely out of his control. One, the mythos behind and the legend of Harry Potter, right? That legend of Harry Potter is something that will always be with him, regardless of whatever he does from now on for the rest of his life.
It's like me. Oh, you're Mary from the Roadshow. Yes. 13 years ago. No, wait, not 13 years ago.
Not 10, 13.
11. 11 years ago.
Yeah.
And that's still how people refer to me sometimes.
Yep. So that will continually and continuously push Harry in a direction, no matter what. But now, because Voldemort is back, something that runs parallel to that, and maybe not even parallel, but it is going to force the legend of Harry Potter to eventually intersect with the brewing fight that is coming. And we have this trifecta of story elements. We have a kid who just wants nothing more than to be normal against the legend of his own mythos. And then we have the oncoming fight with Voldemort, who is fighting against the legend of Harry Potter. Mm-hmm. And they're all going to come together at one point. And this all pushes itself naturally. It logically, emotionally, and also in terms of plot and the momentum of our characters are all pushing towards this point, and it's fueling itself. Like, normal Harry is pushing against all of it, but he knows because he is the chosen one.
But I am the chosen one.
Right. And like, there is that moment where he does say that, right? It's because it becomes an acceptance point. And how do you accept it? Are you accepting it to...
He's not accepting it fully now. He doesn't fully know.
Right. And that is part, again, that's how all of these things are pushing itself. You know, the author doesn't need to create circumstances to create momentum.
Okay.
Because the momentum already naturally exists. One of the things that we talk about when it comes to Outlander, Mary, is Diana Gabaldone has to put the Frasers in specific situations in order to create momentum and tension. Because there isn't, for the first three books, I think there's a natural tension. There's a natural end point.
She doesn't have to do that, you're saying, for the first three books.
She doesn't have to for the first three books because there's a natural end point.
But then after that, when Jamie and Claire separate,
yeah.
You know it's going to be bad news.
Right. And she's separating them because she has to, right?
Unless he comes home with a kitty.
Yeah. And she has to do it because there's no natural endpoint, right? There's nothing that they're necessarily fighting against. So she has to manufacture it. The author here does not have to do that.
You have seen. Okay. Yep.
Right?
Yep.
She does not have to. I mean,
I see what you're saying. And remember, we're now here in the fourth book, but you're just.
Let's bring
it back to Potter.
No, what I'm saying is logically, the author here does not have to do that because all of the forces that she has created from book one all the way to book four, and now that book four is like this spinning point of momentum where it shoots off for the rest of the story. It almost reminds me of like those race cars. That like when they're on the track, you have the spinning wheels that push the race car to go forward. Mm-hmm. We're at that moment right now. We're at the car has come to the point where it has the spinning wheels and we're entering the spinning wheels. And now it's going to shoot us even more forward. That's where we are because of the author at this point. All right. So that's enough of me talking, Marvin. You got anything else that you'd like to say about this chapter, about the book?
I love it all.
About anything else?
I love it all, and I'm excited to go forward.
All right, good. Do you want to do a different perspective?
I feel like we already did with Colin Creevy.
Good point. Okay, fair enough. All right, let's close it out, shall we?
We shall.
Let's do it.
Thank you all so incredibly much for hanging out with us as we have read The Goblet of Fire.
Yes.
So a couple little things I want to give you a heads up about. We're going to watch the movie, recap the movie, and then we will be going into Blake's favorite book, The Order of the Phoenix.
And also remember, we'll be doing a commentary track for those that join the nerdclan.com for this film as well.
Exactly. Yep. So we want to make sure that if you're not yet a member at jointhenerdclan.com, that you head on over. It's really as easy as that website. It's as little as $2 a month, where it's cheaper than getting even a cup of coffee these days.
Yep.
But it really honestly contributes to us being able to create these podcasts for you. So we are so appreciative for those of you who are already members there. And don't forget, we have our Facebook community.
Yes, go just look at Facebook and look up the Mary and Blake group. That's what it is. All the nerds for Harry Potter and all the other shows and things that we cover are there. So there are some great conversations. And don't forget, too, at jointhenerdclan.com, you get all the great benefits like the commentary tracks and Baking with Blake and, you know, the whole thing, instant access to all of our episodes. And it's just big. So
my name's Mary.
My name is Blake.
Mischief managed.